Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. One of the unintended consequences of the American invasion of Iraq was the looting of the country's National Museum. Thousands of antiquities, some of these dating back as much as 6,000 years, were stolen, and many pieces remain unaccounted for. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with the man who at the time was the Director General of Iraq's National Museum, Dr. Donnie George. We'll talk a little bit about the effort to recover what was taken, and also about how rising levels of violence and threats against his life eventually forced him to leave Iraq. He is now a visiting professor of anthropology at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and is here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in a conference that will look at how the forces of religion and nationalism may act to heighten tension within groups around heritage claims, even to the point of causing the destruction of some ancient and historic sites. This conference is titled Contested Cultural Heritage in a Global World. It takes place today and tomorrow on the U of I campus at the Spurlock Museum, and Dr. George is the keynote speaker. He'll be giving a talk tonight at 7:30 at the museum. It is titled Mayhem in Mesopotamia, the Interplay of Religion, Nationalism, and Global Politics in Iraq's Cultural Heritage. His talk is free. It's open to the public, supported in part by the Center for Advanced Study and other units on the campus. Anyone should certainly feel welcome to attend. And, of course, here this morning on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number to call. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest. Until July of 2006, he was Director General of the Iraqi National Museum and Research Director of the Iraqi State Board of Antiquities and Heritage. He's been conducting archaeological research in Iraq since 1976, has a doctorate in archaeology from University of Baghdad. He's lectured around the world on Iraqi antiquities and museums and taken part in many international professional conferences. And we're pleased that he could be with us this morning. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I know that I'm sure probably there's still thinking about what happened is painful. Think back to that point when perhaps things were at the worst and you were walking around your museum and seeing what had happened. Can you describe what it was like?
Well, in fact, you know, I have been in the museum almost 3 days before what happened. I was sleeping there in my office. I could not go back home. But it was on the 8th of April that we had to leave the whole premises. We were determined to stay because we said once the Americans are in here, we should be with the museum to arrange the protection of the museum. But when the tanks were very close to the museum, they have just occupied and controlled the Ministry of Information and the Iraqi radio and television station, which is almost 300, 400 yards from the museum. Tanks were approaching the museum. It was at a point that we have noticed Iraqi militias jumped into the gardens of the museum, aiming their RPG-7s to the American tanks. At that time, Dr. Jaber Khalil, who was the chairman of the board, decided, no, we should leave because now we are in crossfires. We left at the intention of coming back. We went to the eastern side of Tigris. We had some more buildings there. But at about 3:30, we wanted to go back. People stopped us in the middle of the bridge, said, now the Americans have controlled the whole area, and whoever moves is shot immediately in that area, which meant just across the bridge was the museum area. At that moment, I myself felt confident. I said, well, this is quite okay because now they are controlling the whole area of the museum. They know this is the museum because we have signs, big signs there, and they will protect it. So we went back and we distributed ourselves. I went again to my aunt's place. I could not go back home, stay there for 3 more days. And the day when I went back, that was Saturday, when I went back home in the evening, I heard in the news of the BBC that the museum was looted. It was a big shock for me, of course. I decided the next day would go to the American headquarters that was set in one of the hotels there. We went there next day. We finally met someone, a colonel in the civil affairs, and he promised that he would send some protection for the museum. And the same day, that was Sunday. But no one came when we went back. And again, for Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, we were standing there with clubs in our hands, just trying to protect and do whatever we can if another wave of the looters. When we went back there, we understood that there were looters in the museum for 3 days, the 10th, 11th, and the 12th. And I always described it as when I saw what was there inside, I describe it as if a hurricane had hit the whole building from inside. You know, everything devastated, smashed. All the doors were over 120 doors we had in the administration area and all over the area were just completely smashed. Everything was taken away, computers, furniture, and paper and reports were just thrown away all over the building. And not only that, they have, piled up in specific places. I immediately understood that that was done in order to set fire to the whole building. That was exactly what was going on in the other governmental buildings. But thanks God, we were there, but no one came. And it was only on the 16th of April, Wednesday, we had the American protection. American tanks came and stayed there for a while to protect the whole premises of the museum.
So clearly it seems that there were some people who broke into the museum or entered the museum and just had a general sort of idea that there would be something there valuable that they could take. But it seems also very clear that there were other people who knew quite well what was there, what was valuable, and no doubt went in there with the specific intent to take particular things because they knew, no doubt, that they were very valuable and would be very saleable.
Yes, absolutely. After going back to the museum myself, you know, being an archaeologist, a part of my job is to investigate and check things. And this is what I did the very first day when we went back to the museum. I understood immediately that there were three groups of people that went into the whole premises. One of them was the ones that went and just got everything, all furniture, computers, copying machine, all these things that sellable, that they can sell and get money out of it. The group number two were the ones that went into the galleries of the museum. They knew where to break through a window, a hidden window that the museum people had blocked years before. It's a glass brick window, but they have blocked it and completely done, but they came through that one. They brought with them glass cutters. I found them in the galleries. These glass cutters were, I believe, to cut the showcases that we had. They passed by some gypsum replicas we had in the museum. They never touched them. So for me, this second group were good, knowledgeable people that they had planned to go into the galleries. And they got about 40 pieces from the galleries, very important pieces. Group number three were the ones who went into the storerooms of the museum. Again, they went through a door. I myself, at that time, I was not the director of the museum. I was the director of general research and studies. At that time, I did not know we had from one of the galleries a door and steps go down to the cellars of the museum. But they went through that place and went past by a huge hall containing everything. They never touched anything. They went to the second hall, turned to the right. At the end, they hit a group of plastic boxes we had with containing, of course, small items, but very precious items. These were the jewelries and the cylinder seals. They took, from that point, over 5,000 cylinder seals. They are small, but very precious and wanted in the market. And I believe, and even the investigators that we have had from the American forces there, they believe too that this last group must have had some knowledge from inside. We don't know how, but the way they went in, the way they took, we believe they must have had some knowledge from inside. Mm. And that was the whole thing. And one another thing I noticed myself, they have, the ones that went into the galleries, they smashed some specific empty showcases. Now, I made a short kind of study what was in those showcases before the museum was closed. It turned out to be very important pieces were in those showcases that were smashed. And obviously, it looks to me that the people that went into the gallery had a kind of shopping list. And they've been to the museum, they knew what they wanted, and when they came to a place where that piece that was not there, they just smashed the showcase completely. So I believe 100% that the looting of the museum, mainly in the storerooms and in the galleries, was a planned thing that using, you know, arranging thing that, and perhaps seeing that there might be a chaos during the American forces' presence there, they went in. Mm-hmm. And I believe this is exactly what happened.
Our guest, just let me quickly reintroduce our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Donnie George. He was Director General of the Iraq National Museum and Research Director of the Iraqi State Board of Antiquities and Heritage. He's talking here about the events that took place after the American invasion of Iraq and the looting of the museum that took place. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk about these very events. That's 7:30 tonight, and it's open to anybody who would be interested in attending. This is at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that thinking back to some of the first stories that were written about this, there seemed to be a good deal of confusion, and understandably so, about what was taken, how many items were taken, and some very large numbers were reported that I think turned out to be not, fortunately, not as bad as that. Now, at this point, do you feel that you have a number that you're fairly certain of as to how many items were taken? And of those, how many have you managed to have been recovered? Have you managed to recover?
Yeah, first let me tell you something about that high number that started then. Mm-hmm. It was in the very first days, you know, we had journalists coming to the museum, and the first question was, how much is gone? How much is stolen? Mm-hmm. We always told them, we don't know. We don't know because we have to check. It's a museum. It contains hundreds of thousands of objects. But there was one journalist who asked me that, what's the volume of the material you have in the museum? I said, we have over 170,000 numbers, which means the number goes up. Then immediately this number was taken as 170,000 objects were lost from the museum. Mm-hmm. And I always then spoke about it. I said, no, this is a mistake. But now we know that over 15,000 objects have been stolen from the museum, from the galleries and from the storerooms. Of those 15,000 objects, we have back in the museum a bit over 4,000 objects with the efforts of everyone there. And in the neighboring countries and in Europe specifically, in Italy, Spain, Holland, and in the United States, mainly in New York Customs, we have a good number of material that is seized, and the Iraq Museum know about it, and they are documented, and we have promises that they will be taken back. In fact, they wanted to take them back. When I was in office there, I just asked them, please keep them. It's not a good time to bring things to the museum. It's a whole chaos there here. It will take the number almost 50% of what was lost. But it's a good thing, but still we have about 7,000 to 8,000 pieces that are lost. Among them, some very important pieces, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think that this is something that someone has and they're keeping it and they just take it out occasionally and look at it, or they have somebody they can trust, they invite over and they say, come and see this thing that I have, but it's part of a personal private collection that they're going to have to keep hidden?
I think this is the case because some of the material just surfaced in the very first early days and weeks and months, but now we don't know of anything that is surfacing. So I believe this is the case. And because the material is so much known and we've done a lot of publicity for these items and photos, and there was also a kind of red list that was issued by ICOM, the International Council of Museums, just to show exactly what kind of material has been looted from the museum, and all the law enforcement all over the world, they know. So I believe what's smuggled outside or maybe even inside Iraq is just hidden. And as you said, perhaps just going back to it and looking at it. And that's the worst thing that can happen, because then we might not have them from now to 10, 20 years. And but one of the worst thing is that these people are keeping these things as just a kind of money investment. You know, this is the worst thing that can happen to the antiquities here. Just keeping them, they take them out after 10 years or 20 years, and then they will ask for any price that they want for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would think that some of the pieces, though, it would be well known enough so that even in 20 years, if someone pulled that piece out and then tried to offer it for sale, that people in the art world and people in the museum world would immediately recognize what this was, would know perfectly well where it came from, and that there would be no way that that person could, well, you would say that there probably would be no way that their person could have come by that piece in a legal way.
Yeah, it's true, but what worries me that these items would be sold among these people themselves, you know, the underground, and items will be moving here and there in the underground, then no one will know about it. And unfortunately, then we would have lost a great amount of material, maybe for good.
In the run-up to the war, scholars and archaeologists around the world were very concerned about the safety of the museum and the objects there. Concerned enough so that people went to the United States government and the Pentagon and said, look, this is something that you've got to think about. So at the very least, the Pentagon avoided bombing the building. But then there was this question, somebody dropped the ball, providing security on a continuing basis. Before the war, were you in contact, or were other people in the museum in contact with anybody outside Iraq talking about this very issue?
I was informed by this, about the scholars who went to the Pentagon, scholars who went to the Central American administration, telling them, and they actually gave them coordinates for thousands of archaeological sites. Mm-hmm. And in the very last days, some of them also mentioned the museum. And of course, it was also mentioned, but again, in the very last days before the attack, he was just emphasizing, please, you make sure that the museum is protected. And then someone asked him, where is the museum? He again sent the coordinates of the museum. And not only that, he told them, I'm sure there's a guy there. He will stay with the museum. His name is Donnie George. He is a cooperative guy. He will be there, arrange with him how to protect the museum. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, no one came. There was a tank very close to the museum on the day of the looting. Very close. That was about 70 or 80 yards from the main entrance of the museum. It was stationed there. And one of our people who actually lived in the premises of the museum, he saw around 300, 400 people gathering in front of the museum with toll bars in his hand, in their hands, with hammers, guns, and everything. And he knew that they were there to enter the museum. He went to that tank, begged them, please, this is the Iraqi National Museum. It contains treasure. Just move your tank in front of the museum so that these people will go away, not enter. The man in charge of that tank made a call and then turned to our guy and said, I'm sorry, we don't have orders for that. And they just stood there, and those people just went into the museum and smashed everything. And for 3 days, they were in the building, actually.
Something else I want to make sure that we talk about is that while here we talked about these particular events that took place at the museum a little over 5 years ago, over this period of a few days in April, but the problem of looting of archaeological material and archaeological sites around the country continues. It is something that continues to this day. places where people are taking whatever there is to be taking, disturbing archaeological sites that were perhaps in process of investigation. So not only are you losing material, you're losing everything that you learn by seeing where it is and how things lay out. That continues to be a problem now.
Absolutely, yes. And for that, we had looting on the archaeological sites actually started right after the 1991 war. And the peak of that was in 1994-95. And in 1999, we managed to go down. I was one of the people who went down to stop this kind of looting and started making excavations there just to ensure the presence there. And for one side, my side, I had one guard before I employed 15 guards for a 24-hour armed guards, surveillance of that site. We managed to stop that. But after 2003, it came back again. And much more intensive because with all the chaos that was there and the insecurity that was there. When I was in office as the chairman of the board there, I managed to recruit and I started a new system of police. We called them the archaeological patrolling police. And these were connected with us, with me. And we had a man that was an ex-colonel in the Iraqi forces. And he was in charge immediately in charge of them. Little by little, we managed to get them weapons, communication systems, cars from the United States, cars from Japan. And in each province that they were very well equipped, we could ensure the protection of the archaeological sites. They stopped the looters. They took them to courts. They got the antiquities that they had and sent them back to the museum. But this whole system was interrupted when little by little we started having less and less funding from the government to this kind of police. The last thing was that while I was here, I understood that the government reduced the budget for the fuel for their cars. Now, literates, in fact, speaking that they are just sitting in the offices, they cannot go out and patrol because they don't have enough fuel for their cars. And this is one of the chaos that is happening in Iraq, unfortunately. And, I believe it's a very easy thing. I mean, government is not that poor to not pay for the gas for these things. But it's all within this wave of chaos that's all around the country, unfortunately.
Yeah. We are at our midpoint, and I have callers we'll get to in just a moment. But I would like to, again, introduce our guest, Dr. Donnie George. Until July of 2006, he was Director General of the Iraq National Museum and Research Director of the Iraqi State Board of Antiquities and Heritage. He has been doing archaeological research in Iraq since 1970, holds doctorate in archaeology from the University of Baghdad, has lectured throughout the world on Iraqi antiquities, and has taken part in many international professional conferences. He was forced to flee Iraq with his family because of death threats, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the second part of our conversation here. Currently, he is a visiting professor in the Department of Anthropology at the State University of New York in Stony Brook through the Scholars in Exile program, and he's here on the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a two-day conference on contested cultural heritage in a global world. This is taking place today and tomorrow at the Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory. He is the keynote speaker for this conference. He'll be talking on the topic of Mayhem in Mesopotamia, the Interplay of Religion, Nationalism, and Global Politics in Iraq's Cultural Heritage. That is at 7:30 tonight. It is free and open to the public. So anyone who was interested should stop by. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have several. We'll start with the caller in the community of Belgium, not far away. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions, and I'll just put them out to you. First of all, I assume it's the Iraqi government you're speaking about that's not giving you these funds for the gasoline and the automobiles, because surely they would feel the most responsibility for their antiquities. I assume that's who you're talking about. But second question, and the one I don't really understand, in your description of the looting of your museum, you spoke about step one, two, and three. And in step three, it seems though they got the most valuable and the easiest items to get money for. They were small and valuable and easy to transport and probably fairly easy to sell since they're so small. Are you sure you got that right, the order? Because it seems to me that a thief would take the most valuable and easily converted things first and come back for the other things later.
Well, for the first part of the question, yes, you're absolutely right that the Iraqi government should be completely responsible because according to the antiquities law, antiquities and archaeological sites are the custody of the government, and the government should do its duty to protect these things. But it's not happening. This is the problem of the people at the State Board of Antiquities and Heritage. They're pushing so much, but they do not have, until now, they do not have the support of the government. As for your second question, yes, those people, I believe they were separate people. The ones that they went, this group number two went into the galleries, they took some large items from the galleries. But the group number three who went into the storerooms, yes, they took those items because they knew where to find these small items. In that store, we had different kind of material, large copper material, pottery, a lot of pottery. They did not touch that. They only went to those boxes who contained cylinder seals and jewelry. And they took fair amount of material there. And those were, of course, were small items and easily transported and sold easily.
That's what I'm saying. It seems the people, I don't want to cast disparities upon your employees, but it seems though those people would know where the most valuable items are. They would go there first because they had the closest access, and they would remove them the soonest.
Well, we don't have evidences that our staff were there in those days because we had one or two of our staff, and there actually one of them lived in the premises. He never spotted anyone of our staff going there, down there. But they were strangers, but they were Iraqis. But since they went all that way into those storerooms with that knowledge of where to go, we believe, yes, they did have information from inside to go to that spot, that specific spot, to get those small and precious items.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. Champagne, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call and to bring this subject to be discussed. Your respected speaker mentioned that many people went to the Pentagon and to the American government to tell them about this museum and many valuable things to be looted later. Actually, the main reason we are there to loot that nation, it doesn't matter its artifacts, its museums, its oil, its gold, we are there to loot that country and destroy it. And to me, as a human being, it's more valuable to respect the human life. And when our government here even didn't respect the human life, how can they respect something which they don't recognize? Because they have no knowledge what was Iraq before. And so the main reason we are there is to loot that nation. We are looting their oil. We are looting their heritage. We are looting the fabric of their society by dividing that nation to ethnic groups and to run that country according to their ethnic groups. They divided that nation, actually. The previous caller tried to put the blame on the Iraqi government. What's the Iraqi government? There is no Iraqi government. There are puppets installed by the American government, by our government here. They cannot, with all respect to say this, they cannot go to the restroom without asking for a permission. Unfortunately, at this time, when there is a lot of site in Iraq before the invasion, you cannot go there and you cannot drive your car because of the these sites are very, you cannot drive, so you will not destroy if there is anything underground. Today, our tanks and our military vehicles, they are actually, they take their military bases in the top of these sites. So how can this government, our government here, will listen to people who are worried about the heritage of the Iraqis? I don't think they will care about anything except looting that nation and destroying that nation. Thank you very much. This is a comment. This is not a question. But I feel very sorry that we talk too much about, I care a lot about, I've been in this museum so many times when I was a student in Iraq, and I feel so sorry every single minute. But I have more sorrow, I am more sorry for the more than 1 million human beings lost in Iraq, and we're still claiming a victory in Iraq. I will hang up, and if you have any comments, I appreciate that.
Well, I thank you for the comment. I don't know to what extent you want to talk about politics. Any way you like.
I'm a specialist. I always say that. I'm always confronted with this kind of questions. I respect so much the comment that this gentleman had done. And I believe, yes, it's a huge chaos that's happening in that in the country there. A lot of lives are lost. But again, I would emphasize, yes, we are losing a lot of lives, but through the looting of the archaeological sites, until this moment, we are losing a very important part of our common cultural heritage of mankind that is there. And losing lives is one thing, yes, it's very important. But losing the history of that country is something, again, very, very important. And we ought to look and see what we can do about that.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is Pontiac in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you very much for your comments. I remember when this was actually happening. WILL did a lot of reporting about it. I'm an artist and a historian, and I was heartbroken at what was happening and the fact that our military did nothing to help protect. And I remember hearing those statements that they could have just shown a little something and maybe it wouldn't have happened to that extent. And I'm very sorry, and I just think it's really important that everyone know that there are many, many people in this country who do not agree with what was done, how it was done. And we feel terrible that this is still continuing, and I don't know how to end it, you know, as an individual, but I just want to say thank you very much for continuing to bring this to our attention, and I hope it helps.
All right. Well, thank you. Again, you can...
Thank you very much. This is one of my my own goal and a lot of American institutions just to keep this subject in the mind of the people so that we can try every time to do something about it and try to help the institution there, try to help the Iraqis that are still in danger. If you might know that the people working in the Iraq Museum now, when I was there, I arranged a kind of system that only 50% of the people should come every day. Now, in my contacts with the people there, they are only having 30% of the people coming in the museum every day, and that is trying to protect their lives from just traveling from home to the museum and or going back home. So it's a very critical situation, but we need to do our best to protect this whole cultural heritage that we have in common that is there, and to protect and try to help the people that are in on the line there in Iraq.
You left Iraq in 2006.
That's right. Yeah, right.
You and your family. Why did you have to leave Iraq?
Well, it's a very very important question, and I never wanted to leave Iraq. My children were threatened. My two sons used to live with my parents in Dora. And Dora is a place where completely dominated by Assyrian Christian people. And my younger son had a threatening letter from Al-Qaeda people, accusing him with a lot of things, incorrect things, and then asking for an apology letter and a fine of $1,000. Otherwise, the next day he will be kidnapped and beheaded. So I immediately, when I heard that from my elder son, I asked him to bring them to our place because we lived in another part of Baghdad. And immediately I arranged, after a few days, to send them to Damascus to be safe, my mother, my two sisters, and my two sons. I stayed behind with my wife and my daughter, but all the time I had in mind to stay there, even sending my wife and daughter afterwards. But I had then a kind of pressure that I was having from the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities there in Baghdad. And that was finally one step of that was stopping all my authorities as a chairman of the board. And that was, of course, for me, as a specialist working in that institution, if you don't have authorities, why should I stay there? And the final thing was, then I had one of my friends in that ministry, Minister of Tourism and Antiquities, told me, Donnie, you should be aware now, the order had come from Al-Sadr party that Donnie should not stay in his position because he's a Christian. And I was surprised. He was telling me this in order to try to do something to stop that order. I said, no, absolutely, I'm not stopping this order. If they don't want me, if they want to fire me because I'm a Christian, not respecting all the over 30 years of service that I've done to this institution, my country, and I'm a specialist, then I'm not staying. When I applied for retirement, my request was approved in 2 hours by the minister. And I was then at the status of a deputy minister. He approved it immediately, so obviously he was waiting for that. And I understood 100% because of other cases. If I would have not gone away, they would have killed me. Very easy. And this is what's happening in the country. Putting pressure, if you do not leave, then they send somebody to kill you, and that's it. They get rid of you. Hmm. So that was the reason, really. I was determined to stay, but when things started targeting me directly, I said, well, that's enough. I took the rest of my family and went to Damascus.
Yeah. We are, many people would assume that all Iraqis would be interested in preserving the country's archaeological heritage.
Yes.
Going back to the beginnings, as far back as you can go. This apparently is not the case. How much of the pressure that came to bear on you has something to do with attitudes about what actually should be preserved and what should not be preserved?
Well, it goes back, I believe, to so many years back, because if we go to the educational section system in Iraq, when students in the classrooms and the schools study history, they start studying history from the fifth grade, and it's all concentrated on the Arab and Islamic history. They go to the sixth grade, and then they go to the intermediate school for 3 years, and then in high school 3 years before going to college. Only in the first year in the middle school, they get just 1 year of classes for the pre-Islam antiquities and history in the country. That is the Assyrians, Babylonians, Sumerians. And then in this 1 year, they are bombard, I would say, with completely strange names for them, names of kings, of sides, of everything. Then it stops. Then continuing with the Arabs and Islamic history until the high school and sometimes even in colleges. So the majority of the Iraqi people did not have the knowledge of what was in their country. Now, this goes on, and this is why we see the sites that are looted are non-Islamic sites. Completely, just before Islam, everything. And there's another point that this material is wanted in the markets in the Western part of the world. But again, emphasis was always, I had the feeling that the emphasis was there to protect just the Islamic sides, the Arabic sides. I struggled so much to do both, of course, as an archaeologist. Once I had an incident, I was fighting to protect what we call Jami' al-Imam Ali, the mosque of Imam Ali in Kufa, because there were some donors and they wanted to redo the whole ancient mosque, and they were just losing all the ancient parts of it. And someone from the Shiite endowment, he called me and he said, "I'm surprised you are a Christian and you are defending this Islamic monument." I said, "It is a monument and it's my duty to protect it. There's no difference in my mind between Islamic and pre-Islamic. This is the way we work." But on the other hand, we did have a lot of pressure to work on this and just leave this. Mm. Yeah.
We have about 8 minutes left, perhaps, in this part of Focus 580. Just again, quickly to introduce our guest, Donnie George. He was the Director General of the Iraq National Museum until 2006, also Research Director of the Iraqi State Board of Antiquities and Heritage, has been doing research on the archaeological heritage of Iraq since 1976. And is currently a visiting professor in the Department of Anthropology at State University of New York in Stony Brook. He's here visiting on the campus to talk about this very subject that we're here discussing this morning. So people can take the opportunity to hear more from him. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Scholars, archaeologists, people like you all around the world are concerned generally with the loss of archaeological material, not perhaps just from the place that they study or that they're interested in, but that they make this argument that not only if material is that is part of Iraq's history and heritage is lost, that's not just a loss for Iraq, that is a loss for the world. And there is this strong notion that for the benefit of the entire world, this material needs to be preserved and protected, and people need to have some kind of access to it. It's good for people to be able to go and see it. But but often that leads the international community of scholars and archaeologists puts them in conflict with particular governments who, for whatever reason, don't seem to hold their own archaeological heritage in such high regard. And then this is a very difficult question. What can be done? What can outsiders do, either scholars or people of other governments, if the government of a particular country says of their own archaeological heritage, well, we don't care about this?
Well, this is a very, very, very important question, I would say, because I have seen that. I have practiced that. Going back to the first question, I have worked so much with the Ministry of Education to expand that program, in the middle schools. I could not do that. They did not allow me. I offered scholars to prepare programs for them. They did not allow me to do that. And now again, you see what happened in Afghanistan with the Bamiyan. Mm-hmm. That was the government who did it. Now we see what's happening in Iraq. The government itself, it's not supporting the people that want to protect this. And in this case, I believe once the American administration has its hand there, has its hand and have some, I would say, some good influence in the Iraqi government. Since this material is very important for everyone, that's the cultural heritage of mankind. It concerns everyone there. I believe they can put some pressure on that too. They can put some pressure on the Iraqi government. This is a part of your concern that you are not doing good in it. So let's do something about it. We can help you doing something about this. But I think the government itself is not doing that much. Yeah. And they have to be pushed, it looks like, to do that.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. First, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'll make my question quick. Mm-hmm. Well, first off, thank you very much, and I'm sorry for what you've had to go through. Would you consider, if in a neutral country offered a place for some of the artifacts, if you were able to get them out of Iraq, would you consider doing that with allow for a temporary museum to be set up for them?
Well, it is a very good question, and a lot of people have thought about that. But it has other faces, you see. One first thing is that it's a huge amount of material. Mm-hmm. What's there in the museums might go over 500,000 pieces. This is one thing. The second thing is what to do about what's happening in the archaeological sites. Now, we have the registered sites, only the registered ones in Iraq, as are 12,500 sites. And what we have found in these sites, it's just a fraction of what's still there. So in practice, I think it cannot be done. On the other hand, that I believe when this might happen, now you will have the complete confrontation of the Iraqi people. They would say the Americans now stole all of our antiquities. They have been saying for what had happened to this museum, but when this will happen, they will say just, you know, all the people in Iraq, they will say that the Americans had taken all our antiquities outside. Yeah. And I just wanted to say something. The horrible incident of the Iraq Museum had awakened so much Iraqis that they felt that they were hit in the heart for what happened to the museum. It raised the awareness of the people of Iraq about their cultural heritage with the very good intention of what you have proposed. I think in practice it cannot be done.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and it's
thank
been a
you.
Pleasure listening to you.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on to another caller. This is someone in Savoy, line number two. Hello. Caller there in Savoy, line two. Well, perhaps not. If somebody wants to call real quick, we could try to get in another caller. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you think that you're going to be able to go back to Iraq? Would that be your hope, that in fact you could go back
well,
to Iraq?
Well, that's my country. That's home for me. Mm. And going back home is a wonderful thing, but if I can. Now, in the chaos and situation that's going on there, and being myself a Christian, it's very hard now. Christians are having a lot of pressure and kidnapping and persecution and killing. Just 2 weeks ago, a priest was killed in front of his house. So it seems to me that is a kind of systematic that is happening, that just pushing the Christians out of the country. And I don't feel safe now to go there. No.
We'll try, I think, to get this caller. This is in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello. I was...
It would really help us if you could turn your radio down, too, please.
But I got tired of waiting for you to share some time, so I hung up. I wanted to ask the guest if he could explain to us what his theory is as to why the Arabs or the Iraqis, I don't know whether to use the larger term or the smaller term, are doing these things. Why are they breaking in there? The Americans aren't doing that. Why are they drilling holes in people's skulls? The Americans aren't doing that. Why are they decapitating people? I mean, your guest and some of the callers, they talk as if These were Americans' faults and Americans' problems, but I don't think so at all. So I would like to know what his understanding is of why the Arabs do these things.
Well, although this is a completely political question, I'm an archaeologist. I would love to speak about my field, but you're absolutely right. You know, they are always there and raising the question that we are an occupied country. These occupiers should go out, but they are attacking the Iraqi people. But they are killing the Iraqi people. They are, you know, if they attack, if there's one attack on the American convoys, there are 10 attacks for the Iraqi people. What's being killed from the Iraqi people now is, as you have heard from one of the listeners, is over a million people. I don't understand, like you, that much. They are calling themselves, they are the resistance, but they are killing the Iraqi people again. They are calling themselves, they want to liberate that country, make it free, but they are killing the Iraqi people. Iraqis would never do that. Now, a lot of Iraqis believe that whoever is doing that is either pressed by non-Iraqis or the non-Iraqis that have penetrated in the country from Afghanistan, from Sudan, Al-Qaeda people, from Saudi Arabia. These are the ones who are leading all this kind of pressure that they are putting on the Iraqi people.
We must stop because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana who would like to hear more from our guest, Donnie George, he'll be giving a talk tonight at 7:30. This is taking place at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus as part of a two-day conference on contested cultural heritage in a global world. It is free and open to the public. Anyone who would wish to attend should feel welcome. Our guest was Director General of the Iraq National Museum and Research Director of the Iraqi State Board of Antiquities and Heritage, and he now is currently visiting professor in the Department of Anthropology at the State University of New York in Stony Brook. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.